snowmobiles could pass near that point when it was buried under ice, though that didn't really apply much, given it was June. I hadn't been able to locate any canoe reports on the river from the usual sources. The only canoe description I'd found of it, back in Sudbury while digging around in Laurentian University's library, was in a canoe book issued by the federal government in the 1970s. This report, however, was of a rather nebulous character, especially when compared with the other northern rivers in the book. There are a few reasons why this river attracts little notice from canoeists. The giant Mackenzie River, stretching for thousands of kilometers, naturally monopolizes canoeing attention in its vicinity. And if someone is after the splendor of a more wild and majestic river with gorgeous scenery and exciting white water, the dozens of rivers draining down from the nearby Mackenzie Mountains are the obvious choice. For most of these waterways, as well as the Mackenzie itself, hundreds of trip reports are readily available, but not so for the river I was now to embark upon. From the air, the river known as the Hare Indian seems to wind like a giant anaconda through the sparse subarctic forests west of Great Bear Lake, stretching over 200 kilometers before emptying into the Mackenzie River just south of the Arctic Circle. It's a much smaller river than the Mackenzie, measuring only about 250 meters near its mouth, and this decreases the farther up it one ventures. Its waters I found swift and clear, but with a current even more powerful than the Mackenzie's. Again, my plan entailed traveling upriver, paddling, poling, and wading through rapids against the current. I hoped it'd take me no more than 2 weeks, three if conditions were really bad, to struggle upriver and then hike overland to the coastline of Great Bear Lake, hopefully just in time for that mighty inland ocean's ice melt. Despite the stronger current, in the river's lower reaches, I found my paddle could be used effectively by using a technique I'd experimented with previously when needing to paddle up rivers from Hudson Bay. This method consisted of capitalizing on the river's undercut banks, which could be used as a springboard to push off from with my paddle while I remained seated in the canoe. A hard push off the undercut bank was then followed by several more strokes, and then another thrust off the bank, and so on, repeating the maneuver, alternating between thrust and paddle strokes while hugging the shoreline. This strategy allowed me to travel quite rapidly against even strong currents when conditions were right for it. A potential drawback did occur to me, though, as I was springing cheerfully along the banks with my paddle. Those same undercut banks are often thickly grown with willows, exactly the kind of willows that conceal anything lurking within them. A grizzly or a musk ox could be 3 feet away and I'd never know it, which I found was occasionally the case. Battling upriver hugging the banks, should a musk ox take a sudden fancy to charge out from its concealment, it would land right on my passing canoe. Or should a hidden grizzly reach out from a willow thicket to swipe its powerful paw at my head? Well, I'd seen what that did to Betty's steel-plated door. But I reasoned the odds of such a thing happening were quite minimal, so I tried not to let such thoughts trouble me too much as I paddled along, enjoying the plump little yellow warblers singing their songs along the banks. Beyond the willow thickets enclosing the river were black and white spruce, tamarack, poplars, and trembling aspens, hardy trees that can tolerate the extreme cold of these northern latitudes. In places where the banks didn't lend themselves to my paddling method, I switched to poling. It was hard work. My muscles were feeling the ache and burn of continuous hours of nonstop poling, especially when forced to pole up rapids. Difficult as paddling and poling could be, a more serious challenge lay in navigating the river's bigger rapids. This was a problem I'd largely avoided on the Mackenzie, which has few real rapids, and even those I could avoid by hugging the shorelines. But here, in sections of fast-moving water, that wasn't an option. With hard effort, I managed to pole up some of the shallower rapids, although driving a canoe through rapids while standing upright in it is always a precarious proposition. Deeper, more powerful rapids required getting out of the boat and hauling the canoe as I waded through the rushing water. For these, I wore the neoprene hip waders Chuck had given me. Some sections weren't too bad. I'd slosh along, dragging the canoe behind me with a rope. The river was clear, so I could at least see the rocky bottom and be sure of my footing. The exception was in the largest rapids, where the torrent of churning white water made it impossible to see where I was stepping. Here, I had to be extra cautious to avoid twisting an ankle or losing my footing and smashing my head on a rock. My careful plans, worked out in advance, had been very clear on the need to avoid smashing my head off rocks. The key was to read the water correctly, to make the right decision as to where to haul the canoe. I needed the weakest point in the racing waters, where it wasn't too deep. Otherwise, I'd lose my footing and be swept away. One stretch gave me particular trouble. The river cascaded around different gravel bars, causing swift rapids. I had to struggle to maintain my balance in the rushing water, holding on to the canoe's bow to steady myself. I edged forward cautiously, barely lifting my feet off the river bottom. It was more like shuffling forward, trying to avoid being knocked over by the force of the water. Just a bit farther, I told myself. If I can just overcome this surging current, I'll get there. But it was too deep. Another step and the water would be over my hip waders. Reluctantly, I retreated to shore. Fortunately, I'd packed, in addition to the hip waders, a separate pair of chest waders in the event of meeting with deeper stretches. The extra weight of having to pack two pairs of waders wasn't ideal, but chest waders are very impractical to wear all the time. From past experience, I'd found that smaller hip waders allowed for much greater agility, such as when needing to leap from rock to rock or across fallen logs. So it was only with reluctance that I'd packed the ungainly chest waders as a kind of worst-case scenario measure. Both sets were the kind worn with detached boots, so at least I didn't need two pairs of those. On the bank, I switched into the chest waders, then plunged back into the river, taking the canoe and retracing my steps into the deeper waters. I didn't dwell too much on the particulars of the situation, standing nearly chest-deep in a swollen river with frigid water rushing past that just a few weeks earlier had been ice-covered, far from any help, hauling a heavily laden canoe behind me. I just put one foot in front of the other and kept going. That's often the best approach, I find, when dragging canoes upriver. Lurking in the deep, weedy pools along the banks were northern pike. These stealthy hunters hover in calmer sections, waiting for smaller fish or even unsuspecting ducklings to happen along. Pike weren't the only wildlife about. In one winding stretch of river, after I'd left the rapids behind and switched out of my chest waders, I caught sight of something small, dark, and furry moving on the opposite bank. A black bear cub. Most of my route was outside the range of black bears, but here, where the tree line surged northward, black bears reach the northern limit of their natural range, which extends right up to the Arctic Circle. As such, these black bears are the hardiest of their kind in the world, putting up with long, dark, brutally cold winters. However, unlike grizzlies, black bears avoid the open tundra, preferring to remain south of the treeline. My route here partly overlapped with their range, but as I continued east, the black bears would disappear as tundra came to predominate. This little cub was apparently alone. I watched it wander along the bank for several minutes until it disappeared from view. I hoped it wasn't lost and that its mother was merely hidden somewhere nearby. That night I made camp on the riverbank. It wasn't my most pleasant campsite, as the shoreline was filled with pebbles and rocks, which I hadn't much choice but to sleep on. That old report had warned that the Hare Indian River was mostly covered with willow thickets along its banks, which made camping difficult. Thus, I felt I couldn't afford to be too choosy when it came to finding any spots free of willows. At any rate, sleeping on rocks isn't the worst thing in the world, especially when you've got a wild, majestic place all to yourself. With my tent set up on the rocks, I dipped my head into the cold, rippling waters of the river. It felt wonderfully refreshing. On the Mackenzie, I hadn't done anything of the sort. Its waters were so silty and muddy that when I dipped my hands in them, they quite literally came out dirtier than when they went in. But here the water was clear, allowing me to see right down to the pebbly bottom and the vivid green reeds dancing in the current. Refreshed, I crawled into my tent and stretched out on the rocks. I felt around with my hands through the tent floor for any particularly troublesome ones, and, grasping them through the tent floor, tossed them aside as best as I could. Then I pulled out my maps to study my progress. In total, my route encompassed hundreds of topographic maps. When I'd reached the end of one map and the start of a new one, I'd set aside the old map to be burned in my fire, thus literally burning through my maps as a measure of my progress. Just then, I heard something pass over the tent. It made a kind of swooshing sound, as of wings flapping, and a strange call, like someone knocking. If you've ever had a raven fly over your head, you'll know the odd, unnatural noise they make, and how unnerving it can be if you have a superstitious turn of mind. Judging from the sound, the raven outside continued to swoop back and forth around my tent, as ravens are wont to do, making other surreal noises, but mostly that odd knocking sound. Although ravens are most famous for their deep, croaking calls of the sort featured in horror movies, they have an amazing vocal range that includes not only knocking noises, but also shrill cries, raspy chatters, and even mimicry of other birds' calls. In my rambles around the hills of Sudbury, ravens would often pass over me, making the same eerie knocking noise I now heard coming from outside my tent. I poked my head out and caught a glimpse of a large, glossy black bird flapping across the river before it vanished over the spruces. I thought to myself, when camped alone in the wilderness, one can certainly appreciate why ravens feature prominently in horror stories. I took it as a good sign, then lay back down on my rock bed and fell asleep, dreaming of ravens. Chapter 6. Into the Swamp. The farther up the river I went, the wilder it became. Each bend I rounded, each rapid I waded through, took me farther from the haunts of humans and deeper into a land of wolverines and musk ox. The shallow, rocky rapids along the river's winding course ensured that no motorboats could reach up it, leaving it as an oasis for wildlife. There were bald eagles perched in spruce thrones, and in the waters swam green-winged teals, mergansers, and golden eyes. Sandpipers hopped along the pebbly banks, while robins and yellow warblers provided music. The robins singing, "Cheerily, cheer up, cheerily, cheer up," and the warblers chiming in with their whistling, "Sweet, see, 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 swee." Beavers loudly slapped their tails in the water as I passed by, and muskrats were also about. In one spot I heard a moaning cry, a little baby beaver, lost among some reeds, searching for its parents. I hoped it found them. If not, it might provide lunch for a fox or passing eagle. There were signs of moose along the banks, as well as caribou. Meanwhile, wolves stalked along, hunting the numerous musk ox. On my third day poling up river, I saw a total of 4 musk ox, each of whom stared curiously at me. One was barely 10 feet away, concealed on the riverbank as I poled by. Neither of us noticed the other until we were directly opposite each other. The musk ox snorted, apparently shocked to see me, and then glared with its enormous eyes, seemingly mystified by my presence. I apologized for the intrusion and pulled hurriedly away. More interesting, perhaps, was what I couldn't see from the river. Inland, I knew, stalking like phantoms amid the shadowy gloom of the black spruces, were lynx. These living ghosts are the North's most elusive creature. Beautiful big cats with sphinx-like faces, thick gray coats to endure the harsh winters, and giant, oversized paws that act as snowshoes so that they can move soundlessly, specter-like, across deep snows. The farther up that twisting, winding river I ventured, the more I began to wonder about that old 1970s government canoe report. It had described the river as lined with willows along its entire course and flowing through a subdued and gentle rolling landscape. But I kept seeing things that didn't match that description. In the first place, the willows weren't as numerous as the report suggested. Perhaps that kind of change might have happened through natural processes like regeneration after a forest fire, though the evidence on hand didn't seem to support such a theory. But when I started to encounter towering tabletop mountains with sheer cliffs hundreds of feet high. It became hard to reconcile such cliffs and rocky uplands with the report's description of subdued and gentle terrain. I wondered whether the authors had actually explored the river, or if perhaps they'd lost their field notes and couldn't remember what they'd seen. I found it a landscape to give free rein to the imagination, a place where one could daydream for hours while poling to the point of numbness against the current. It was in the midst of one such daydream, of dinosaurs stalking amid the towering limestone crags overlooking the winding river, while poling near the bank, that I noticed an odious stench wafting on the wind. Something was dead, very dead judging by the smell, somewhere nearby. Another pole thrust and I saw what was giving off the stench. A dead musk ox lying on shore, half concealed by willow shrubs. A rapid analysis of the fly-covered carcass suggested that it had most likely been ambushed by a grizzly that had ripped open its neck. Large as they are, musk ox are occasionally killed by grizzlies when they're caught unawares. In this case, the grizzly had apparently eaten its fill, leaving the remains to be picked over by ravens and other scavengers. I doubled my pace, pulling hard to get back to pure northern air. That night I made camp within sight of a big sandstone outcrop crowned with little spruces. What wood there was I gathered for a fire to make spruce tea. In the last 4 days I'd made it some 100 kilometers up this mysterious river, the waterway becoming narrower and the trees thinning steadily. Though diminutive in size, many of these spruces, I knew, were quite ancient. The harsh conditions and short growing season meant that, despite their size, some were centuries old. Soon they'd disappear entirely, and I'd be back on the windswept tundra. In the meantime, I enjoyed their shelter, reminding me as they did of a childhood spent wandering woods. I slept peacefully that night, until branches snapping around 12:30 jolted me awake. I grabbed my bear spray and unzipped the tent's screen door. Under the midnight sun, I could see all too clearly a bear's face staring right at me. The bear's body was hidden in willows, with just its head visible, about 20 feet away. Camped alone in the wilderness, many miles from any other human, with a bear outside my tent, I thought to myself, that's the very stuff of childhood dreams, if your dreams at all resembled mine. It wasn't a grizzly or polar bear, at least, merely a black bear. It's not that I dismiss black bears as of no particular concern, but they're familiar animals, and though still big, say about 300 pounds, they don't have quite the intimidating dimensions of grizzlies and polar bears. Still, there was something in this black bear's face, staring as it was at me, that I found unsettling. It looked uncomfortably like it was sizing me up. I tried talking to it, telling it gruffly to not even think about it. In the meantime, I fished out my bear banger and stepped outside the tent. Fortunately, my canoe was lying overturned between the bear and me, forming a psychological barrier separating us, if not an actual one. "All right," I said. "I've asked you to leave and you haven't, so now I'm going to fire a banger and give you the scare of your life." I pointed the banger toward the sky, then pulled on its end, unleashing a flare that shot up high and exploded with a bang. It was so abrupt and loud, echoing across untold miles of wild, silent country, that it startled even me. The bear barely flinched. He remained exactly where he was, staring straight at me with an icy look in his dark eyes. Apparently, bears don't find bear bangers as frightening as musk ox do. So I grabbed my paddle, it was lying beside the tent, and started shouting to scare off the bear. After all, such tactics had worked with the charging grizzly. As I did so, I spun the paddle around in my hands, then swung it violently against the overturned canoe, banging against it like a giant drum to add to my intimidating display. Surely, this would work. The bear, however, responded by growling in a low, guttural way, his gaze still fixed on me. Apparently, he wasn't easily frightened. I thought of my bear spray nearby, but I didn't want to use it if I could help it. So I mustered up an even louder barrage of shouts, deeper and more menacing, and really swung the paddle now, threatening the bear should he try anything. This finally seemed to work. The bear, huffing and puffing, now edged back, and slowly, very slowly, started walking away. He shuffled off along the river, remaining partly concealed in the willows. I kept my eyes on him, gripping my paddle as I did so, until he moved out of sight. Then I kindled up a blazing fire nearby on the rock-strewn bank. The fire, I hoped, would keep the bear from returning. I waited a while for any sign of it, but it seemed to have gone, so I crawled back inside my tent and forced myself to fall back to sleep. Difficult as sleeping alone in bear territory might be, particularly after you've just had a bear growl at you, I knew that without sleep, I wouldn't have the energy needed to continue. Sleep was a necessity, plain and simple. And thus I slept, with my bear spray handy. As the days went by, each one taking me farther from the world of emails, phones, screens, laptops, and incessant news cycles, I felt as if I were pulling back in time. It felt relaxing to turn my back on those things, even in spite of bears interrupting my sleep. Personally, I think the more we can step away from our society's deepening addiction to digital screens, to 24/7 connectivity, to unnecessary clutter, the healthier we'll be. Immersed in nature, one feels alive. Shut up indoors all day, staring transfixed at a screen, one loses something. But to return to the peace and tranquility of nature. As the temperatures warmed, immense, suffocating hordes of blood-sucking insects filled the air. My throat was soon pockmarked with blackfly bites, my beard smeared with blood stains, and my wrists, waistline, and anywhere else the flies could get at covered in itchy sores. Prior to mid-June, the weather had been cold enough to keep away the bugs, but now they were out with a vengeance. I didn't suffer alone. Thick clouds of insects hovered around the musk ox, caribou, and moose, feasting on them mercilessly. One moose I spotted must have had a million mosquitoes and blackflies on it. The poor animal took to the water to escape them, but above the waterline the bugs still swarmed its head and ears. Having grown up on the edge of a swamp, I had a particularly high tolerance for mosquitoes, though blackflies are a torment for everyone. I told myself now as I fetched my mesh bug net out of my backpack to get some relief, to take heart that these storms of bugs were merely temporary. If I could just put up with them for the next 2.5 months, the return of cold weather would take care of the matter. 3 weeks since setting off on my journey, and now fully 8 days of traveling up the Hare Indian River, my body was feeling the ache and wear of continual travel. My legs were bruised from stumbling into unseen rocks beneath the water's surface. The tendons in my fingers were sore from poling for long hours each day. At night I'd stretch them out gingerly, but I knew there wasn't much I could do. I was at the mercy of the elements, and so to take any time off was out of the question. My feet were blistered from the waders, and my big toenail on my left foot had fallen off. But otherwise, I felt fine. The river was getting smaller, little more than a creek now. The water continued to alternate between calmer sections I could paddle up and faster, swifter sections that could only be navigated by painstaking wading and dragging the canoe behind me, often for hours on end. This wading, given the rocky bottom, took a toll on my toes, but I made light of it. Toenails, after all, grow back. The shallow sections were full of Arctic graylings, a beautiful fish with a vibrant rainbow hue to their big dorsal fins. I'd happily eaten graylings in the past, but alas, on this journey, if I were to reach my goal, there was no time for fishing. Food was mere fuel, to be consumed as I marched and trudged along. Even my customary morning oatmeal I'd forsaken in order not to lose time setting off early. To stay healthy, though, I did occasionally make spruce tea, since spruce is high in vitamin C, something my dried rations lacked. Caribou, wolves, eagles, musk ox, and bears were all plentiful in the wild upper reaches of the twisting river. One beautiful Arctic wolf, his white coat streaked with black and gray, was particularly curious about me. He was a big, lanky animal, and followed me along the riverbank for over 1 kilometer as I paddled along, so drawn by curiosity that he almost seemed to wish to speak with me. He'd cock his head to the side, eyeing me up and down. There wasn't any hint of malice in his look. Indeed, the wolf, a true symbol of wildness in a world with ever less of it, was shy and skittish. The slightest noise by me, such as a simple "Hi there," or my paddle bumping against the canoe, caused him to jump back, startled. But then, as I quietly continued on, he would follow. Finally, he vanished into the spruces. Never in my life had I ever seen anything so perfect, so magical as that great Arctic wolf. It filled me with awe and wonder. It was a rainy morning when I crawled out of my tent at 5 a.m. on June 22nd to get a start on the day. The sound of a caribou swimming across the river had stirred me from a pleasant dream. I'd camped on a sand bank within sight of some cliffs. In the rain, I soon had my tent down and rolled up, my barrels carefully loaded into the canoe, and my day's rations set out so I could grab them as need be from the bottom of the canoe. I was eager to be underway, as I sensed I was at last nearing the end of the Hare Indian River. Soon I'd be facing the prospect of traveling on foot across trackless and unknown terrain, transporting in stages my canoe and barrels in order to reach the coastline of Great Bear Lake. Before it came to that, though, I knew from my maps that the Hare Indian River flowed through two long lakes connected by what was left of the river. These lakes I referred to as the Headwater Lakes, since they were the river's source. Beyond them was one more long, narrow lake, after which lay terrain of uncertain character blocking the way to Great Bear's coastline. Whether it be possible to make it all the way to each of the lakes by water, or whether the interconnecting river would dry up before then into a tiny trickle, or become clogged with natural debris, I didn't know. The satellite imagery I'd examined beforehand was insufficient to determine such details, and I'd lost all faith in the reliability of that old 1970s canoe report. At any rate, those authors were canoeing downriver, not up, and they'd only started at the first of the headwater lakes, supposedly, whereas I'd have to go well beyond that to reach Great Bear Lake. Poling, wading, and paddling saw me advance another 24 kilometers that day. Things were getting much harder, though. The river's upper section wasn't much more than a beaver creek now, and increasingly unnavigable. The first hints of change came the next day, when I hit a long, marshy lowland. The grassy marshes were quite unexpected, and reminded me of the tidal marshes along coastal rivers in New Brunswick. The water here was too shallow for poling as the heavily loaded canoe hit bottom, so I had to get out and wade, listening to shorebirds calling in the marsh as I hauled the canoe with rope behind me. In the distance, a blue ridge rose high against the clear sky. Somewhere beyond that, I figured, were the headwater lakes. I pressed on, sloshing through shallow stretches, forcing the canoe over them. Then I saw something glinting along the marshy stream banks, something that made a shiver go down my spine. It was the remains of river ice, clustered on shore and melting in the June sun, a reminder of how recently these waterways were still frozen. The remnant ice boded ill for what I might find on Great Bear Lake. If it was still ice-covered, I'd be faced with a delay that might spell the end of my journey's hope of success. I pushed on to find out. The first of the headwater lakes, fortunately, I found free of ice. I paddled straight across its 5-kilometer expanse in 40 minutes, seeing how in nearly 800 kilometers of traveling, it was the first water I'd paddled on without an opposing current. I'd almost forgotten what it felt like to paddle a canoe normally, without battling wind and current, and that such things could be peaceful and pleasant. Alas, it was but a brief respite from the increasingly punishing nature of my journey, now that I'd quite run out of anything resembling a navigable water route. On the far side of the lake, the river continued. It widened into a swamp filled with dead spruces and tamaracks protruding from the water at odd angles, after which the remains of the river rapidly diverted into several channels, each thickly grown over with spruces and willows. The day was warm, sunny, and windless, making the clouds of mosquitoes and blackflies extreme. The tangled jungle of alders, willows, spruces, and tamaracks gave the creek a claustrophobic feel as I followed its snaking course. The thick clouds of biting insects didn't improve things much. Dead trees across the waterway forced me to climb carefully onto them and then haul my canoe up and over so that I could resume paddling on the opposite side. It was hard work, given that the heavily loaded canoe weighed more than I did. Soon I arrived at a place where the swampy creek forked in two, It wasn't immediately clear which fork I should take. My maps and GPS were no help. Neither had the kind of detail needed to accurately discern swampy channels. It was clear they weren't terribly precise, as my plotted position on the GPS showed me on dry land somewhere, which wasn't the case. I was smack in the middle of the remaining waterway. So I set aside the maps and GPS, and instead read the landscape. Neither fork looked promising. Both led straight into log jams. The bushes and fallen trees had become so thick that I couldn't see much beyond 20 feet in any direction. But examining the current, I detected a stronger flow from the left fork, so I resolved to follow it. I was still heading upriver, and sooner or later, it seemed, this waterway was going to dry up and disappear. There was barely room to swing a paddle inside the thickets, but I jabbed and pushed along as well as I could. I'd gone only a short distance before a log jam formed of dead spruces barred the way forward. There was nothing for it but to get out of the canoe and into the water. Carefully, knowing how easily I could slip and cut open my leg on one of the log's sharp, snapped-off branches, I began the back-breaking labor of clearing a passage. First shoving, heaving, and pushing with the weight of my body to get the logs out of the way, then lifting, hauling, and ramming my canoe to get it through. The jam continued as far as I could see. The sight of such a nightmarish string of obstacles before me, combined with the relentless hordes of blackflies, made me briefly wonder if on balance it might not be wiser to quit now, point my canoe downstream, and paddle with the current back to the Mackenzie. Fortunately, this was but a passing delusion, and saner heads prevailed. I banished such thoughts and instead plunged into the river up to my waist, heaving with renewed force to batter the canoe over the logjam. I smashed branches aside and forced the canoe through like a medieval battering ram against a fortress gate. Then, to squeeze under the next jam, I had to get down into dark water that rose above my waist, flooding my hip waders and drenching me. There wasn't anything to be done but to keep going. I was in the zone now. You know that zone you get into when you've been canoeing up rivers alone in the wilderness for a month? That was the exact zone I was now in. With renewed vigor, I shoved, heaved, and twisted my way up and under successive log jams. One fallen spruce formed a kind of bridge across the narrow creek. To get around it, I scampered up its trunk, balanced on my chest on top of it, and threaded the canoe underneath with my legs dangling in the air. But this triumph was short-lived. Around the next bend lay a log jam that made a mockery of all others. It was massive, impenetrable, and utterly demoralizing, a colossal pile of dead trees that looked as though a beaver the size of Godzilla had heaped them up. To hack through it with my hatchet would take months. I had no other option but to portage around it, through the swamps of alders and black spruces. Since it wasn't possible to carry everything at once, it would have to be done in stages. My easiest load was my backpack, which held my tent, spare clothing, tripod, hatchet, and other survival essentials. I strapped it on and plunged off into the green alders. They were almost as tall as me, making seeing ahead difficult, but they didn't last long, as the vegetation abruptly gave way to a foul bog. I picked my way elf-like across it, trying not to step in the wrong place, seeking out the mossy patches of firmer ground wherever they existed. Next, the ground sloped up, revealing more fallen spruces to climb over and alders to push through. Once through these obstacles, having managed to bypass the giant logjam, I could see where the creek resumed. It wasn't exactly clear sailing, there were more jams ahead, but they weren't so bad as to rule out relaunching the canoe. But first I had to retrace my steps back to where I'd left the rest of my gear. So far I'd only completed the easiest load, my backpack. Next I'd have to transport my two barrels across the swamp. These would have to be taken across one at a time, as any more weight would just cost me to sink into the muck. The bugs in the midst of the swamp were dreadful, swarming me as I labored back and forth across it, transporting each load successively. The bug net I was wearing over top my broad-brimmed hat didn't make much difference. Blackflies always seemed to find a way to squeeze through eventually. Finally, I went back for my canoe, dragging it behind through the alders and across the morass. When I came to the ground that sloped upward, I lifted the canoe over my head and carried it in order to get around the toppled dead spruces. At last, panting and sweating, I reached the spot where my backpack and barrels were waiting. No sooner had I repacked the canoe and launched it back into the swampy creek than I arrived at another log jam. Wearily, I climbed back out of the vessel, summoning up whatever strength I had left. Grabbing hold of the canoe's bow, I hoisted it up onto the first of the fallen spruces. Then I began heaving it across the barricade of dead trees. The jam continued for some ways. Luckily, though, I was able to slip back down into the water where a spot opened a bit, crouch down, and then wade under the fallen trees as I dragged the floating canoe behind me. The water once more rose above my waist and flooded my hip waders. Soaking wet, I kept edging under the dead spruces by kneeling in the water, forcing the canoe to scrape beneath their claw-like branches. At last, I emerged from the swampy log jams to a welcome sight before me, the blue waters of the second of the two headwaters lakes. Like the first, it was long and narrow, and enclosed by towering spruce-clad ridges that in places had vertical rock outcrops amid heaps of tumbled boulders. There were caves visible on the rocky slopes, making me wonder whether grizzlies or wendigos might inhabit them. A Pacific loon cried hauntingly from somewhere across the water. Despite their name, Pacific loons are found in the Arctic, and are cousins of the common loons farther south. I made camp on the lake's north shore, knowing I was now getting close to the mighty, frightening expanse of Great Bear Lake. In the meantime, I enjoyed the soul-filling splendor of a wild, lonely lake I had all to myself. My soaked clothes I left drying in the branches of a dead spruce. Then I found a pleasant place on some soft moss and lichens, and I stretched out and slept. Hard as the previous day had been, harder challenges yet awaited me. After paddling across the lake in the early morning, I headed down a short, swampy stream that promptly dried up, meaning yet another portage. Back and forth I went through the willow swamps, transporting each of my four loads, the two barrels, backpack, and canoe, mosquitoes and black flies swarming horrendously. The incessant biting of the flies and mosquitoes was almost maddening, since my hands were full and unable to swat them away. A high rocky ridge remained in sight to the east. I used it as a guide so I wouldn't lose my way amid the willows and suffocating clouds of swarming insects. Eventually, I came to a small, nameless pond amid the willows. This little pond, I realized, was the true headwaters of the Hare Indian River. That's to say, its farthest source, lying beyond even the two lakes. The little pond was barely more than 200 meters across. But I decided to spare myself what little portaging I could by transporting my loads to its muddy edge, then paddling across before resuming my struggles on its far side. It seemed probable that I was the first person ever to drag a canoe all the way from the river's mouth to its swampy, inaccessible headwaters, if only because under any normal circumstances to do so would be utterly impractical, if not completely mad. When it came time to transport the canoe, I simply dragged it behind me through the willows, mosses, and grasses. The dragging was made more difficult than it ought to have been, owing to the fact that inside the canoe, adding to its weight, were my hiking boots. I'd kept my waders on for the portage, as well as the beaver pole, which I knew I'd still need, fishing rod, my emergency food plan, and the wheeled cart, a dubious idea. Why did I have a wheeled cart? It was the cart I'd bought in advance in case I needed to wheel my canoe along the gravel of the Dempster Highway. That hadn't been necessary, but I kept the cart in spite of its bulk and extra weight, because of a report I'd read of an Arctic canoe trip done a few decades ago by two paddlers. They'd reported using a wheeled cart to great effect to lessen their loads on portages, and I'd hoped to do the same. So far, the willows and uneven ground had precluded any hope of using it, and thus it became more dead weight for me to haul in the canoe. I consoled myself with the thought that I might yet meet with some favorable terrain where it could be of use. Once across the small pond, I portaged on, not entirely sure which way to head. Again, my maps and GPS weren't of much use here. I hoped to find a stream flowing in the other direction, out to the last of the three long lakes, since this would mean I'd reached the Great Bear Lake watershed. The willows gave way to sparse woods of tamaracks and black spruce, the uneven ground cloaked with caribou lichens and aromatic shrubs of Labrador tea. As the name suggests, the leaves of that plant have long been used to make tea, and in springtime their pretty white flowers add a touch of beauty to somber subarctic forests. I navigated intuitively, rounding some swamps and trudging through alternating terrain, until I happened upon a welcome sight, a tiny creek not more than a ditch, where the water flowed the opposite direction, east. That could mean only one thing: I'd crossed a watershed divide, or else become hopelessly lost. A few steps behind me, all the water was draining west, down into the Hare Indian River and onto the Mackenzie, and from there out to the Beaufort Sea. A couple of steps the other way, the water flowed east, through tiny creeks and lakes to the vast waters of Great Bear Lake itself. The little stream, less than a foot wide and ankle deep, was too small to paddle, but the sight of it cheered me all the same, as I at least now had something to follow. Several hundred meters farther on, it widened into a shallow creek that twisted around through an open sort of meadow before disappearing behind a willow thicket. The water here looked as though it might be deep enough to at least pole my canoe, so I dropped my backpack by the bank and returned for the other three loads, swatting hordes of mosquitoes as I went. Transporting each of my four loads individually meant that to advance just 1 kilometer, I had to travel 7 times that distance on foot, as not only did I have to carry the four loads separately, I had to retrace my steps back to the start each time to get the next load. This depressing arithmetic made me especially eager to find any watercourse that would allow me to resume travel by canoe. The little creek flowing east offered that hope, so I pushed myself hard in order to get everything to its muddy banks. But I'd met with too many creeks in my life to pin my hopes on one. They often come across as charming at first, but then, once you've gotten to know them a bit, they dash your hopes. Such was the case with this little stream. After I pulled along for just a few hundred meters, it led right into a willow thicket that blocked any passage forward. The bugs here were among the most intense I'd ever seen. Unable to press forward in the canoe, I reluctantly stepped out into the mud, sinking to my knees as I staggered toward firmer ground. The willows were impossibly thick. Portaging through them wasn't an option. I had no choice but to unload my gear from the canoe and struggle across the deep mud with it to more solid ground, outside the willow swamp. Here the ground sloped upward, with black spruces and a few tamaracks. Scanning ahead, I couldn't make out any clear water, just a tangled mass of willows that seemed to suffocate the little creek I'd hoped to follow. I sighed, realizing that my longest and likely most difficult portage yet now lay before me. With my backpack and a paddle as a walking stick, I set off to seek the end of the willows and the return of navigable water. The ground was uneven, rising and declining into small gullies. In some places I had to claw through thick clusters of black spruce. In others, I plunged through willow thickets taller than me, making me apprehensive grizzlies or muskox might be lurking about. I tried to do the polite thing and announce my presence by talking out loud so as not to startle them. Hopefully, they'd do the same for me. After about 1 kilometer, I finally reached a point where the stream looked navigable. I set down my backpack on the bank, then returned to fetch my next load. It was a warm, sunny day, the temperature climbing to the mid-teens. All the portaging, perhaps combined with the bugs that were incessantly draining my blood, gave me a terrible thirst. I'd filled my water bottle before leaving the lake that morning, but it was empty now. Nearly 3 weeks had passed since my water purifier had broken, and so far, drinking untreated water had no apparent ill effects on me. But I drew the line at drinking from a beaver swamp. Thus, I pushed on without water, continuing the long, grueling portaging. Yet, the painstaking effort required to carry each of the loads over rough, uneven terrain became increasingly difficult to maintain without water. By this time, I was sweating and nearly exhausted. I slouched down to rest and thought the matter over. It seemed on balance that the odds were greater that I'd pass out from dehydration than get sick from drinking untreated water. So, upon such logic, I filled my bottle from the little creek. Before drinking, I held the bottle up to the sunlight, making out tiny organisms in it. "That's just extra protein," I told myself, before taking a gulp. It may have been that I was badly dehydrated, but the water seemed to taste especially delightful. At first, I thought, I'd only drink a small amount, enough to keep me going. But then I drank a little more, again reassuring myself that the odds of anything bad coming of it, based on that science paper I'd read, were minimal. By late afternoon, I'd finished the portage and was able to relaunch my canoe in the creek. The narrow creek was still tightly hemmed in by willow bushes, but it was deep enough to float a canoe in. But despite the depth, the narrow banks made it impossible to paddle in the water. So to make progress, I had to stand upright in the canoe and jab with my paddle at the banks, propelling myself onward. Still, I kept hitting bottlenecks where I couldn't squeeze through. Here, I'd have to climb out and struggle among the willows and clouds of biting insects to haul the canoe and my gear around, until the stream widened again. In a few places, I found that I could stand on the bank, wedge the canoe sideways, and with hard effort heave it through the bottleneck. This spared me from unloading and reloading, the trick being not to turn the canoe too far on its side and spill everything out. Gradually, the twisting little stream led me onward through the willow jungles and sedges until it widened out and tamaracks and spruces reappeared. I didn't want to get my hopes up, but then I saw some golden-eyed ducks, a cheering sign, as it surely meant there must be larger water nearby. Sure enough, a few more strokes and the creek emptied into a beautiful lake set amid low hills. After the swamps, it seemed almost like a mirage. I paddled out onto the narrow lake after the golden eyes, filling my water bottle over the side of the canoe. Then I made camp happily on the lake shore amid clusters of Labrador tea, sphagnum moss, caribou lichen, and black spruce, familiar things that always made me feel at home. That evening, recuperating with a freeze-dried meal, I listened to distant thunder. A storm was on its way, probably gathering strength over Great Bear Lake, which I hoped to finally reach the next day. I took shelter in my tent, drifting off to sleep while the storm passed away to the west. The morning dawned with a fierce wind blowing from the northeast under gray skies. The wind brought relief from the bugs, but made me somewhat apprehensive about paddling to the end of the lake I'd camped on. It was about 6 kilometers long, and I needed to reach its far end before I could begin the final phase of my quest to reach Great Bear's coast. My maps indicated a small stream draining from this nameless lake, twisting and snaking southward eventually into Great Bear Lake. I doubted it'd be large enough to paddle, but with luck, I might at least be able to wade through it and drag the canoe behind me, thus sparing me a difficult portage over rough terrain that, with all my loads, would total over 11 kilometers to reach Great Bear. But first I had to somehow overcome the headwinds that were sweeping across the lake. I lingered taking down my tent and packing things up in the hopes that the wind might slacken a bit, but it seemed only to grow stronger. Well, I thought to myself, there is nothing for it but to give it my all. That's my general approach to things. I packed up the canoe, took up my bent shaft paddle for the extra power, and shoved off into the wind. All my effort and energy I threw into paddling, fighting the wind with every stroke. Progress was painstakingly slow, but gradually, stroke by stroke, my canoe edged forward. What motivated me was the thought that if I couldn't succeed in overcoming these gusts, I'd have no chance at all in the vastness of Great Bear Lake. And thus, by such logic, I paddled on. An hour later, I reached the lake's end. The small stream that drained from the lake I located without difficulty. It was shallow, with rocks protruding from its rippling waters. There wasn't any chance of paddling it, but I was at least able to heave and drag the canoe over the rocks while sloshing through the water. This went on for some ways, but my hopes that the stream would deepen after a few kilometers were dashed. Instead, it became shallower, to the point where dragging the canoe any farther seemed unwise. My canoe had been designed to be extra strong and tough for me by Novacraft Canoe. They'd manufactured its hull from a cutting-edge composite material made of basalt fibers, melted down from basalt rock, and anigra, a flexible polypropylene fiber. The two materials were then woven together and infused with a high-impact, waterproof resin. The result was an ultra-strong canoe, sturdy enough to withstand all kinds of abuse from rocks and ice that would puncture and destroy a traditional canoe. They demonstrated this to me when I visited their factory in London, Ontario, by showing me a video of the canoe prototype being pounded repeatedly with sledgehammers and emerging unharmed. Then, for good measure, they'd thrown the canoe off the roof of a six-story building to the asphalt parking lot below. My own early experiences with canoe construction had been somewhat more traditional. My father and I had built canoes from cedar and birch bark sewn together with spruce roots, along with other materials found in the woods surrounding our home. I had a great fondness for those traditional canoes, but they weren't designed to withstand constant gouging by rocks and ice, or being tossed off buildings. Yet, as remarkably strong as Novacraft's canoe was, I noticed with some alarm that the rocks were beginning to tell on it. The frequent pounding and grinding it had undergone as I'd hauled it upriver had begun to wear away some of the fabric. There were no leaks yet, but if the canoe punctured, I'd be in serious trouble. I could improvise a field repair to keep me afloat, but any patch I devised wouldn't be remotely strong enough to withstand the thousands of kilometers of harsh terrain that still lay ahead of me. It required delicate handling and daily repair, things that were simply impossible given the difficulties of the route and the time constraints imposed by the Arctic seasons. Thus, after a kilometer of dragging the heavily loaded canoe over the rocks and listening with some consternation to the sound of it scraping against them like nails on a chalkboard, I decided I hadn't any choice but to go back to portaging. There wasn't any sign of the stream deepening, and I didn't want to risk puncturing my boat with further dragging. I'd come to a vast, open rocky plain stretching off into the distance. It was a strange, barren sight, devoid of plant life aside from a little moss and some scattered clumps of sedges and dwarf willows. This rocky plain, it seemed, was an old riverbed that had drained into Great Bear Lake. All that was left of it now was the tiny stream. The stream, for what I could see, wound around it, meaning I could cut across the rocks on a diagonal, meeting up with the stream on the far side. The better part of the day was taken up with this wearisome portage. The stream on the far side was just deep enough to paddle, and there I reloaded the canoe. Alas, it was but a short paddle before it narrowed too much to squeeze through amid willows and high banks. I once more had to empty the canoe, carry my gear ahead, then delicately turn the canoe on its side, squeezing it through the narrow creek that was in places only a foot wide, though surprisingly deep. Eventually, the creek widened out into a waterway I could paddle. By evening, I could see ahead of me something in sharp contrast to the demoralizing swamps I'd been passing through. High sand dunes, with Arctic terns and gulls soaring above them. I paddled on with anticipation, realizing that Great Bear Lake must be near at hand. The temperature had dropped considerably in the face of an icy wind that was no doubt blowing across hundreds of miles of Great Bear's frigid Arctic waters. With gloved hands, I paddled on, passing by sand dunes, until a surreal sight suddenly revealed itself to me. Like an ocean, the vast, seemingly limitless expanse of Great Bear stretching beyond the horizon. I'd reached it at last. Chapter 7. Across an Inland Sea. I beached my canoe on shore, then cut across the white sand, passing clumps of dune grasses until coming up a slight sand ridge. From the ridge, I saw the immense, ocean-like extent of the world's eighth largest lake, Great Bear. My route now lay across it. A huge, towering iceberg loomed up out of the water in the shape of a pyramid. Beyond it, farther out across the vast, cold waters, I could make out several more bergs. Their white sides were tinted blue, and from a distance they looked almost like the sails of ships. Gray skies stretched away to the horizon while cold Arctic winds swept across the lake, whipping up surf along the beach. The beach extended as far as I could see up the coast in either direction, miles upon miles of fine white sand that made it look like Nova Scotia, aside from the fresh grizzly tracks I'd stepped over to reach the ridge. The icebergs were somewhat unexpected, since they're normally associated with salt water, not inland lakes. In the ocean, they form when chunks of ice break off from glaciers or an ice shelf of the sort seen in Greenland and Antarctica. Examining the nearest berg from the sand ridge, I concluded it most likely formed as a result of the surf piling up drifting pieces of ice one on top of another. Once they'd piled up out of the water, they'd partly melted to form the solid 20-foot-high pyramid I now saw. The Arctic Circle cuts across Great Bear's deep, clear waters, making it by far the largest lake in the world's Arctic regions. It covers an immense area, some 31,153 square kilometers. That's much bigger than Lake Erie or Lake Ontario. And at nearly half a kilometer down, it's deeper than all the Great Lakes, even Superior. Such profound depths, combined with its northern latitude, keep Great Bear's waters frigid even in midsummer, when the water temperature hovers just a few degrees above freezing. But what really makes Great Bear unique isn't its size, depth, or northern latitude, but its wildness. Of all the world's giant lakes, Great Bear is the one least touched by humans. Africa's Lake Victoria's watershed is home to over 30 million people. North America's five Great Lakes have along their shores such sprawling cities as Chicago, Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Toronto. Siberia's Lake Baikal, remote and isolated as it seems, now has some 2.5 million people residing in its basin. Great Bear Lake's vast watershed, meanwhile, boasts one tiny settlement that could fit into a single high school gymnasium. These facts I knew beforehand, but standing alone on the lake's desolate shores, staring off at distant icebergs in a place that felt so wild and remote, stirred in me feelings of awe and wonder at Great Bear's grandeur that no facts could ever capture. Now, more than ever, I could feel the solitude of my journey. I was excited and eager to begin paddling, but I concluded that conditions ruled out setting off until the wind died down a bit. I made camp near where the nameless creek I'd followed emptied into the lake. Beyond the beaches were mostly windswept tundra dotted by clumps of low-lying willow bushes and occasional clusters of black spruce. The cold wind had thankfully dispersed the clouds of bugs. I set up my tent just beyond the beach on a level patch of sand, bearberries, and lichens, where there was plenty of driftwood for a fire. The fresh grizzly tracks made me a little wary, so I kept an eye out as I boiled water for some tea and a freeze-dried meal. Since my waders were still wet from the swamps, I hung them to dry on a small, though ancient, spruce. With the nearness of the lake, the temperature had dipped considerably, and now I wore my heavier waterproof jacket, fleece sweater, thermal base layer, and gloves. With a steaming cup of tea in my hands, I stared across the water at the horizon. In a straight line, it was nearly 300 kilometers across that vast expanse of open water to where I needed to get to, a small river on Great Bear's eastern shore. But there was no way to paddle straight across the lake in my canoe. Not if I wanted to live, anyway. Instead, my plan was to hug Great Bear's north shore, following it all the way across the lake. Given the heavily indented nature of the rugged coastline, with its array of bays, inlets, peninsulas, and islands, the actual distance would be much longer. If I played it safe and never risked any big open water crossings, the total distance would increase to approximately 443 kilometers. How long that would take was impossible to say, depending as it did on wind and ice. Maybe 2 weeks, maybe three. If the wind was bad, paddling would be impossible. Lying inside my tent that cold night, listening to the waves lap against the shore, my mind ran through different scenarios, though mainly that pounding surf and fierce waves would make paddling fraught with danger, capsizing my canoe in the icy, storm-tossed waters. I envisioned shivering with hypothermia as the waves swept over my head, and I struggled in vain to reach the shore before sinking into the depths. But, like with anything, at times you just have to set aside negative thoughts. Whether it's a case of a rough day at the office or the job site, getting stressed out about an exam, confronting a difficult boss or client, or crossing Great Bear Lake, sometimes you just have to tell yourself,
Everything will be fine. An icy wave isn't going to flood my canoe. That's the power of positive thinking. It really does make all the difference. A storm gathered over the lake in the night. Thunder bursts and rain pattering off the tent kept me from sleeping too soundly. Although actually, I didn't wish to sleep too soundly. Up until now, my days had followed a set pattern. Rise early, set off, travel all day, make camp, sleep. Then do it all over again. But now, the lake would determine my schedule. If it was too rough to paddle, I'd sleep. Otherwise, I had to be prepared to set off whenever conditions allowed. Whether it was night or day made no difference. Thus, I didn't want to risk missing a calm spell by falling into a deep sleep, which probably isn't wise anyway when grizzlies are nearby. What made this strategy possible was the fact that I was in the land of the midnight sun. I hadn't seen a star in a month. Continuous daylight meant I could paddle all night if need be, while sleeping during the day if the wind was bad. The storm blew itself out shortly after 3 a.m. A dead calm, eerie in its near-perfect stillness, settled over the lake. I'd slept only 3 hours, but by 3:20 I was up, and by 3:55 I was paddling hard over Great Bear's icy waters in my little 15-foot canoe. I followed the shore, hoping to make the most of the calm conditions. The water was clear as crystal, despite overcast skies and places I could see 30 or more feet down. The lake's cold, oxygen-rich waters breed monstrous lake trout that can live for decades and grow to fantastic sizes. The biggest ones reach in excess of 4 feet and weigh over 100 pounds. Lean as I was from a month of rations and hard travel, my mouth practically watered at the thought. But I wasn't here to fish. I had to keep paddling. I passed landscapes of varying description, white sand beaches, rocky coastlines, stunted spruce forests, an open tundra that looked almost park-like given the natural short vegetation. In places, the fierce winds had sculpted the dwarf spruces, bending them low and leaning them away from the lake. Along the northern shores of Newfoundland, one sees these kinds of gnarled, twisted spruces where they've been shaped by the Atlantic gales and where they're known as tuckamores. Such tuckamore trees testify not only to the power of the wind, but also to the resiliency and adaptability of tough northern conifers. My route took me north up the lake's western coastline. Once I'd reached the north shore, I would turn east. The skies remained overcast and gray as I paddled, with rain falling intermittently. Twice rainbows formed across the water. The sight of them felt almost bewitching, given the sudden infusion of vivid colors over gray skies and dark waters combining with the isolation of the place, its utter vastness, and the all-encompassing solitude. 5 hours of paddling without a break brought me to the extreme northwest corner of Great Bear Lake's Smith Arm, one of the 5 great arms or gigantic bays that give Great Bear its distinctive shape. This is the loneliest of all lonely corners of the lake. It had an almost indescribable feel to it. Well, not physically. I can describe that no problem. It was wet and cold. But spiritually, it had a kind of magic to it. A place seldom visited by humans, where the rocks seem as old as time. So old as to be almost beyond human conception. Drifting on the still, clear water, I breathed in the solitude, the beauty of dark spruces and quiet hills, finding it all refreshingly peaceful, especially after the swamps. Rounding this wild bay marking Great Bear's extreme northwest corner, I crossed over to the lake's north shore, leaving behind the western end of Smith Arm. I paddled on for another 15 kilometers before abruptly stopping. What brought me to a halt wasn't the return of the wind or waves, or even my own exhaustion. It was ice, and lots of it. Ice floes of varying thickness, some thin and clear, others still thick and snowy, formed a pack extending from the shore far out into the lake, blocking the way forward. It looked like there was open water beyond the ice, deeper out in the lake, but I knew that at such distances appearances can be deceiving, and that what I thought was open water might only be more ice. Half a kilometer on, a headland jutted out into the lake, blocking the view farther along the shore I'd been following. Pack ice clustered all around it. But whether the far side of the headland was more ice or open water, I didn't know. To risk paddling far offshore in the hopes of evading the ice, and then gambling that there wouldn't be more pack ice on the far side, was too dicey. If I ventured out there in my canoe only to discover the passage blocked, and the wind or the waves picked up while I was far offshore along the ice, I'd be trapped and could be swept out by the shifting ice into the heart of the lake. With my route blocked, I made camp on shore near the start of the ice floes. There was no way forward until either the ice melted or the wind shifted and blew it farther into the lake. Normally, Great Bear's ice is nearly all gone by late June or early July. In planning my route, I'd had to calculate on reaching Great Bear at just the right time. Not too soon, when it was still iced up, and not too late either. It wasn't easy to forecast when the ice would melt and how long it would take me to arrive at Great Bear, given the number of variables involved, but it seemed I'd reach the lake at more or less the opportune time. I was optimistic that this would be only a short delay. I made camp on a small beach with plentiful driftwood washed up on it. Beyond the beach were spruce and willow swamps,